Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
In America, you get foodie. You won't have to run through the jungle and scuff up your feet. You just sang about Jesus and drank wine all day. It's great to be an American.
Hello and welcome to another cheese-filled episode of Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. I'd like to thank our sponsor for today's show, Hearst Ranch, as well as our super talented engineer and producer, Nat Wiener. Today on Cutting the Curd, we're joined by two passionate caseophiles, Conrad. And Conrad, I don't know your last name, but you'll have to help me out here.
It's Heuser. Hello.
Conrad Heuser of Chass & Co., a distributor of Swiss cheeses, and the American Robin to his Swiss cheese Batman, Sarah Zabrowski, an ex-colleague of mine and current cheese maven at Columbia Cheese. Welcome to Cutting the Curd.
Thank you.
Now we're literally going to get into some foreign territory today. Me being, you know, a purveyor of exclusively American cheese, we're going to talk about European cheeses and talk about Conrad's company as well as sort of the behind the scenes business of distributing artisan cheese, which is not easy. But before we do that, I would like to start with what I hope can become a little tradition on Cutting the Curd and ask Sarah and Conrad how they got into the world of cheese to begin with. Most cheese people that I've met weren't born into any kind of cheese background, so the twisted tales of how they ended up selling cheese, making cheese, are always very interesting. So maybe, Sarah, do you want to go first?
Well, I guess since I'm the younger, I have to go first.
He pointed at you.
I've always loved food. If I can point to cheese specifically in my childhood, there is fondue, which is very Swiss, of course. My father had a tradition of making just really delicious dinners on Monday evenings. And there are a couple cheese-related things like fondue and pizza. And
who doesn't love pizza?
Exactly. Especially when your father makes it very well.
Aw.
So I started with that. And I think I just have a good tongue for food, I should say. And I hadn't really thought about going into it professionally necessarily, but at college I studied sort of urban studies and planning and such, and you know, then realized all the bureaucracy and red tape and all that bullshit.
Not so fun.
Not so fun. And but my passion for food, I realized, was very strong. So I started cooking professionally and ended up running a sort of small organic kitchen in Pennsylvania.
Did you go to school for cooking, or was that just out of your love for it that you kind of got into it?
Well, I did go to school briefly. I went to the French Culinary Institute in New York City.
A great school.
To get some, you know, sort of traditional groundwork. But I'd always been just very hands-on in general with things. So that's really the way I learned very much about food. And somehow I got an itch for cheese, and so I would go around with the cheese primer and go and hunt down
Steve
cheeses.
Jenkins, classic
exactly,
book.
Exactly, exactly. So I would just, you know, hunt down cheeses and enjoy them and learn more about them, and I realized I didn't want to cook for the rest of my life, and I just found these, you know, great things to do with cheese, and I got an internship at Artisanal, and I moved on to Murray's, and actually I spent about the last 5 years at Murray's.
You were like the mainstay at Murray's.
Well, that's right. That's where we met.
That's where we met, yeah.
So, yes, and I learned incredible amounts there and ins and outs of various departments and such. And, I mean, that's definitely where I learned the bulk of cheese. So,
And now you're kind of, you're at Columbia Cheese, which I have to admit, I don't fully understand completely. So you'll have to tell me what kind of a company that is and how, what you guys do a little bit.
Yeah. Well, Columbia Cheese is an importing company. And we work with three specific suppliers. So there's Teresa, that's in Lombardy, Italy. And there's Käsekuche, which is in Bavaria.
Did you just cough?
No, I'm just kidding.
I just said their name properly. We can Americanize it to Käsekuche if you like.
No, definitely not.
and the third sitting to the left of us is Chesenko, which is cheese and more. In Switzerland. So we worked specifically with their cheeses, importing them, and just like kind of general representative for them. So, for example, if you're whoever within the U.S. and you have a question about their cheeses, you can always contact me.
Fantastic. Well, I know we're going to get at some point. I see four delicious cheeses on a plate in front of me. So hopefully we'll get into the storytelling part of this.
I hope so.
Sooner rather than later. But so, Conrad, can you tell us, how did you fall in love with cheese?
First of all, I always like to look into my mother's cooking pots. That's how it started, my passion for food. And as far as I remember, I wanted to become either a chef or a train driver. And I did none of them.
But you came close.
Yeah, I came very close.
But now you get cheese to chefs, and I'm sure maybe trains are sort of involved in the transportation of your cheeses.
Yeah. So, but finally I became a sports teacher, which I did for quite some time, about 10 years.
Now, a sports teacher in like a high school? What were the age of students?
Yeah, it was a high school and university. So,
okay.
But after about 10 years, I thought, well, am I going to do that for all my life? And I said no. So I quit the job and started traveling. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, I'll be away for maybe 6 months. And it turned out to be 5 years.
Wow. What was your first destination? What was your first?
That was New Zealand. Okay. And then I hopped over to Australia. And from there, I traveled on to Southeast Asia, Japan, China, and finally found my way back to Switzerland. And back in Switzerland, I met my former colleague and friend, Urs, mm-hmm. who at the time run three retail shops for cheese.
Okay.
And after a few years of insisting, he convinced me to join the business. So that's what I did about 8 years ago. So from then on, I work with cheese.
And while you were doing all of that traveling, were you tasting cheeses as you went? Was cheese a part of your travels at all?
Not very much, though, in South East Asia, not in Japan.
That's sort of difficult, yeah.
Not very much in Australia. I tasted my first block cheddar there, which was not very exciting. But I really started loving the products once I came back, yeah.
That's amazing. So can you tell us a little bit about your company, which, by the way, being the Midwesterner and not knowing any German at all, I was thinking was Chaz & Co.
Yeah, it's quite a nice sound. It's got nothing to do with music, not with jazz. But Chaz is actually the Swiss-German name for cheese, for Käse.
Yeah. Okay.
So and Käse & Co. means Käse and other products. So we beside cheese, we do a bit of pasta, Swiss pasta. We do a bit of Swiss bread and fruit bread, and yeah, that's part of our product range.
Are you guys responsible for that beautiful pasta that I see at Formaggio Essex?
That's true. Yeah, this lovely blue packing spaghetti and tenete on the vermicelli. Yeah.
The most beautiful packaging you have ever seen, and it's delicious too. I bought it and have cooked more than one dinner's worth.
Yeah,
it's really, the amazing thing about Switzerland, how there are so many different parts of it. So
Such a small country, but touches so many others. Yeah.
Yes, it's actually coming from the southern part of Switzerland, the Italian speaking part. So it's a really Swiss pasta, Italian style pasta, but in produced in Switzerland. Yeah.
Amazing. And so you guys represent the cheese part of your business. How many different countries or regions does that represent?
Well, first of all, we buy a lot of Swiss cheese from small producers, but we also import cheese from France, from Italy, and also from England, from our good friends Niels Yard.
Niels Yard, yes. Awesome. they source excellent cheeses.
Mm.
So you're sort of in the business of sourcing cheese from partners, like you were just saying, or in the case of the Swiss cheeses, do you guys go out yourselves and find the farms and create those relationships?
Yes, we go out and find the dairies, because it's quite a different system in Switzerland compared to like here in the US. There are actually virtually no farms that cheeses, but mainly there is a village dairy, and the dairy will buy the milk from the local farmers. Yeah,
which is a good model, which is something that, you know, it would be interesting to see more of in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
For those of our listeners who don't know, farmstead means that the milk to make the cheese comes from the farmer's own herd. And what Conrad is talking about is farmers from a region pooling their milk to be made into cheese. It's sort of a collective facility.
Yeah. And it's much even smaller than a region, because if you think of the geography of Switzerland, which is so mountainous, you have, you know, valleys and hills and all sorts of things. So it kind of makes sense that you might have, you know, 5 or 10 farmers who just go to the, you know, the place in their town to bring their milk, you know, once or twice a day. Because, gosh, you really don't want to trek right over that hill or mountain, do you?
It's true. It's in a way, it's a beautiful thing. It's all about cooperation and pooling of resources and, you know, allowing everyone to do the part of the job that they probably like the best. The farmers make the milk, the cheesemakers make the cheese. And
that's exactly what we believe in. Yeah.
Yeah.
True. And also that we are just a part of the of this long chain of providing an excellent product to the consumer. Like everybody does what he can do best, yeah.
And what we can do best right now anyways is eating, which is always the most exciting part. Actually, it's time to take a really quick break. But when we come back, let's dig into these cheeses in front of us and maybe talk a little bit about how they get from these tiny valleys in Switzerland to this plate at Roberta's Pizza.
Let's do so.
All right, we'll be back.
Singing to someone. This is a song about U.S. foreign policy. It's called Political Science, so let's drop the big one. I'm glad you feel that way. No one likes us. I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. When all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize them. Asia's crowded and Europe's too old. Africa's far too hot and Canada's too cold. And South America stole our name. Let's drop the big one, there'll be no one left to blame her. We'll save Australia. Don't wanna hurt no kangaroo. We'll build an all-American amusement park there. They got surfing too. Boom goes London and boom Perry. More room for you and more room for me. In every city, the whole world round, would just be another American town.
and there will be. We'll set everybody free. Wear Japanese kimono, baby, Italian shoes for me. They all hate us anyhow. So let's drop the big one now. Let's drop the big one
now. We are back on Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network, where the studio is perfumed with cheese. And Sarah Zabrowski is cutting the curd right in front of our very eyes with a butter knife, which is really impressive. They didn't seem to have many cutting implements available for us. So can you tell us, what are we looking at here? What are these cheeses and who makes them? And
Sarah, do you want to start with? Because you've visited Ernst Dierivachter in Krümmenswil in the Toggenburg.
In the Toggenburg region in the northeastern area of Switzerland. So, actually, we've been talking to a lot of our customers about his cheeses recently.
What's his name again? Just so
Ernst Dierivachter.
Ernst Dierivachter,
yeah. And he is actually the producer of Forsterkäse, which you are probably familiar with, and some of your listeners maybe as well. It's a small wood-bound wash-rind semi-soft cheese that is
cow's milk, right?
Cow's milk, yep. That is incredible.
And what does that name mean, Forsterkäse?
Well, the forester is the guy who takes care about the forest. I don't know the proper expression in English.
Lumberjack.
Ranger? Or?
Yes, the forest ranger, maybe, yeah.
Okay.
Good, yeah. So.
And because this cheese is bound in bark.
Yeah, it's a spruce bark, and this is the reason why he calls it the Förster cheese. Yeah.
And the Käse in German is just means cheese.
Yeah. Okay. The forest guy's cheese.
Yeah.
I love it.
They're all very simple names. Especially in Switzerland, they're often named after kind of the town or the region or a nearby. In fact, yes. One of the cheeses we'll taste is named after a mountain. So. Yeah.
Well, should we try a little bit and see? Oh my gosh, this looks so good. I'm used to only eating American cheeses now, but I remember the Forsterkäse from my days at Murray's, and it was so good. Very, very pungent, this cheese. How would you describe this cheese, Conrad?
Well, it's got a very intensive flavor of wood. But you'll also smell the milky part, and it's got a nice for this type of cheese. It's quite strong, actually.
It is, and as it ripens, the bark gets a chance to kind of penetrate the paste a little bit more. So if you get a piece that's sort of closer to the rind, you start to notice it more and more.
That is absolutely delicious. It's very. It's very thick. It's very hearty. And I like it because it's pungent, but you still get that kind of, you still taste the sweetness of the milk, which is amazing.
So this is actually considered a mountain cheese, as the altitude is about 700 to 800 meters.
Mm-hmm.
And we work with the term mountain cheese not because of the mountains, because the herbs are quite different from the lowlands, and the herbs, they add to the real flavor of the cheese.
Sure, that makes sense. The whole old adage, you are what you eat, it applies to cows probably more so than to us.
Yeah.
What about the second cheese? What are we looking at there?
On the second one, it's called Le Charmant, and the Forsterkäse is kind of the godfather of Le Charmant, actually.
Okay. It's very in the mafia sense?
Well, maybe not quite as illicit or of that sort. But it's very similar in terms of the production of it, but instead of doing just a normal Brevet bacterium wash on it, and instead of putting a pine bark around it, he uses a sweet white wine to wash it.
Wow. What's the wine?
Well, maybe this is the mafia part, because Ernst...
I knew it had to be there somewhere.
No, because Ernst uses a sweet wine from Sicily, and this to the recommendation of a second generation Italian guy who lives in the area, and he just recommended to use Sicilian sweet wine. So maybe, yeah, this is the mafia part.
I like it. Every cheese tastes better if it's twinged with a little bit of mystery and intrigue.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a beautiful cheese. Yeah. Mm. Completely different. I mean, much kind of spongier in texture. Has like a touch of bitterness, but very pleasantly so. It's a beautiful cheese. So can you tell me a little bit more about this gentleman who's the cheesemaker? Who does he get his milk from?
Well, the he gets the milk just from the local farmers, and this Ernst will buy about 2,500 liters a day in the peak season.
Okay,
and he is he gets it from many different farmers from the region. So we counted about 20 different farmers.
Okay.
So each farmer has a very limited number of cows. From some have only 10 to maybe 25.
That's great. That's a good size.
It's a good size, but it's also a tough work on the dairy, on the person who runs the dairy, to keep the hygienic standard high with the farmers.
Sure.
To also assure that the product will be fine.
Absolutely. You put a lot of trust as a cheesemaker in your farmers and in the person who runs the dairy.
Definitely. Yeah.
And so is this gentleman, is he a cheesemaker from, you know, forever ago, or is he new to it? Is he...
No, he learned the business of a cheesemaker at a young age, and he was always a cheesemaker. So, but what I know, his family was not in the cheese business before, but he was a trainee, or he did an apprenticeship as a cheesemaker, which takes at least 3 years.
Wow!
Yeah.
Wow! And so, what
is he in his late 50s maybe now?
He's in his 50s, yeah.
Okay. Mm. And these cheeses that we're tasting, are these typical to this region of Switzerland, or are they his own cheeses? Are they his own creations?
Well, it's only about 15 years ago since the Swiss cheesemakers are allowed to make other cheeses than the well-known brands such as Gruyère, Emmentaler, or Sprints. And actually Ernst used to be a Tilsiter cheesemaker, and he still produces a certain amount or number of Tilsiter, but beside that he really likes to produce his Förster cheese or Le Charmant, or maybe the next one, the Wolzen cheese, we are going to try very soon.
So that's a good lead in. I'm still hungry. What's the Wolzen cheese?
What do you want to explain it, Sarah?
Well, the Wolzen cheese is it's a small cheese, about 4 pounds or so, and it's got a lovely sort of burnished rind with various kinds of molds growing on it.
It smells burnished. It smells like roasted nuts, or
smells a little toasted, sort of. And in fact, you know, he kind of says in a way it's based on Sprins, and sometimes it gets to that sort of dry point. Right now, the wheel that we're tasting is a little more, slightly more moist, and it's maybe about 10 months or so at this point that it's been aged. So I tasted it the other day, and it was kind of like a coconut omelet or something like that. And
toasted coconuts, completely. People think that, like,
I just have to say this one odd thing, because when I tasted this cheese, I thought of you.
Oh!
Because when I think of Petit Ardi Gosna from France, I remember you and coconut. And I tasted this cheese and I thought of Anne.
Isn't that funny, the way that smell and taste works? It just, like, takes your mind to a completely different place. This cheese is amazing. The coconut thing, yeah, I was trying to put a finger on it. I was thinking caramel corn. What is it? There's something kind of sweet and caramelized about it, but it is toasted coconut. Amazing.
Yeah, this is really a lovely cheese, and it stays, as Sarah said, for up to 12 months in a natural cave. So it's got enough time to mature. And since the cheese is quite dry, it doesn't affect the cheese too much. But it's a really lovely cheese. We just discovered it recently. Because quite many cheesemakers, they produce a cheese just for the local market. And that's one of those that we discovered.
Wow. That's amazing. So how did he learn to make these cheeses? If these are cheeses that are a departure from the typical Swiss cheeses, the Tilsiter and the Sprinz and all that, were they of his own invention, or did he have sort of inspiration that came from...
Well, I think some of the cheesemakers are just curious and like to experiment. And here are the results of new cheeses. That's how it goes.
Well, that's just incredible, because that was actually one of my initial questions. I feel like in some parts of Europe, cheesemaking is sort of let's just say there's not many new ideas being produced. It's very strictly regulated by AOC laws or DOC laws, and people really aren't allowed to experiment quite as much. Whereas in the United States, people are allowed to make whatever they want, call it whatever they want. Some of it's great, some of it's got awful, but the experimentation is there. So to hear that that's happening now in different parts of Europe as well is really pretty cool.
I agree. I think tradition is very good, talking about AOC, but it also can restrict the cheesemakers to not being creative. Mm-hmm. So this is a very fortunate situation that we have in Switzerland right now.
It's kind of funny. It's all in flux. I guess initially cheeses were made because there was certain milk available in a region. There were certain constraints put on the cheese, depending on the size of the cheesemaker's herd or the habits of the cheesemakers or the natural materials that were nearby, be it bark or leaves or wine or whatever. And then that kind of got more. So then once those cheeses were popular, they became strictly regulated and there was no experimentation allowed. But now people are kind of moving back towards the redefining what they want their cheeses to taste like. Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but this is something that I think is completely fascinating and should be, you know, sort of more people should definitely know about it. The distribution side of getting cheeses from these small producers to large markets like New York is not an easy task at all. And I was wondering if you guys could tell us just quickly. Or not so quickly. I'm sure it's complicated. But how in a nutshell does a cheese get from your producer to someone's plate in the United States? Because it's an incredible sort of gymnastic of
it happens quite quickly, actually. I think much quicker than one might expect. But it certainly starts with Conrad and with the cheesemakers, and well, Conrad can speak about this, but he's, you know, they're very exacting about, you know, what is what they're working with in terms of within Switzerland and, you know, for export to other parts of the world. So,
well, that's Switzerland is very small. We have deliveries from our cheesemakers once or twice a week.
And you have a warehouse where you store them?
Yes, we have a warehouse, but especially for the cheeses coming to the US, we do not store them, but we order them according to what is needed in the US. So every shipment, we get a fresh shipment from the cheesemaker. Then we pack the cheeses up into boxes, we label them in our warehouse, and then the cheese is picked up by a trucking company and is shipped to Paris. And then it's Sarah's business from there.
to Rungis?
It's going to Rungis, to the platform of Euro Larkin, yeah.
Okay, and so Larkin is, and Euro Larkin, I feel like they're kind of the magic lever in all of these things. So then Larkin is responsible for getting the cheese from Rungis, the big wholesale market in Paris, to New York. Does that happen by boat or by plane?
It happens by boat, and it's, I mean, vast amount of cheeses. It's actually kind of amazing if you ever get to be there and kind of see a container of cheese opened and pallet after pallet, and it's, you know, it's cheese from France and Spain and Italy and Switzerland and, you know, Bavaria and all over the place.
And the irony, because we are sitting in a shipping container right now. I can only imagine what it's like full of cheese.
You know what a container looks like.
Yeah. Right. It's a lot of cheese.
Right. You're right. So, I mean, the journey across the ocean is a little less than 2 weeks. So your cheeses do definitely have to be a little younger to make the journey.
And properly packed.
Exactly. Like the first Urquiza, like you remember, like you just tasted, it's, you know, it needs to be a little bit younger because it has a few more weeks of traveling before it gets, you know, to a distributor and then, you know, finally to a retailer or to a chef or so.
So it's an incredible amount of communication that happens between you guys and Conrad and his colleagues.
Conrad probably gets too many emails from me.
I agree. I checked my emails with Sarah. It's about 1,000 over the last 12 months. So.
Well, she's doing a good job. These cheeses are in good shape. Well, and so once they land here, just very quickly, I found this to be one of the most fascinating things that I learned. Once they arrive at Larkin here in New York, Larkin is a bonded warehouse. No,
yeah, it's a custom bonded warehouse.
Mm-hmm. Can you just describe what that is quickly? Because it's fascinating.
Well, I mean, it means it has certain responsibilities. I mean, basically, if you go back to and I'm not the expert, but if you go back to, I don't know, the 70s or so, there was a issue with enough sort of people being a customs bonded facility. And so they looked to people outside of the customs department strictly to do this for them.
Oh,
so
they kind of contracted out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, what that means is it just kind of speeds up the process, quite frankly, of just getting the cheese to the customer. Because all of that can kind of go on within the facilities. You don't have to hold it at another facility until you can get it to another spot.
So for a product like wine, it wouldn't be a big deal because a product could sit in a warehouse for months and sort of be relatively unchanged. But with a product like cheese, it's perishable. Having a bonded warehouse then means that cheese is getting to the customer faster.
Right, right.
Fascinating. I just think that how cool is that to, you know, sort of be an agent of the customs.
It's true. It is a great place because, I mean, you'll have cheese come in and then, you know, 48 hours later, it's on its way to California or you know, Seattle or Portland or something. So it's pretty amazing.
And so finally, for people who are in New York, where could they find some of Conrad and his cheesy cohorts products?
Oh, gosh. There are plenty of places. I mean, in terms of going in and just buying the cheeses, there's Murray's Cheese, there's Formaggio Essex, as you both mentioned. There's Brooklyn Larder. There is Green Grape. There's so many other folks because we do have a New York distributor for the cheeses. So.
Fantastic. Well, these have been absolutely delicious, and I thank you both for taking the time to come out and chat on Cutting the Curd. And I wish you luck in your journey to California for the
Thank
Fancy
you.
Food Show.
Yeah,
thank you. Thank you, and it's great to be with you. Thanks.
Hope you'll come back.
We'd love
sure
to.
We will.
You just sang about Jesus and drank wine all day.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.